From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Boston's new school superintendent is ready to make the city her home.
I sure hope that people will adopt me. I can certainly adapt to the culture.
Plus, scientists have detected something they've never seen before, the likely collision between a neutron star and a black hole.
Gravitational wave astronomy is really just getting started, and it's this whole other window in the universe that we've never had before.
Also today, could the answer to Boston's traffic woes be in Mexico City? And 9/11 changed the world. And in a new book, Boston journalist Mitchell Zukov recounts the fateful final moments on that blue-skied September day 18 years ago.
9/11 is becoming a story reduced to numbers, but you don't connect names to it. And I felt if I could give people the story as it unfolded through the people that they could connect to, then I would have done something worthwhile.
That's next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Kimberly Atkins. It's official. Boston Public Schools have a new superintendent. Last night, the school committee chose Brenda Caselius over the other two finalists, Marie Izquierdo and Oscar Santos. Caselius spoke with WBUR's Morning Edition this morning and said that even though she's not from the area, she's excited to make Boston her home.
I sure hope that people will adopt me. I can certainly adapt to the culture and know the climate already, so that won't be a problem.
For more on the choice, the selection process more generally, we're joined by school committee chair Michael Leconto. Michael, welcome to Radio Boston.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And also joining us is Edith Bazil. She's the president of the Black Educators Alliance of Massachusetts. Edith, thank you for joining us as well.
Hello, and thank you so much.
And Michael, let's start with you. I'm sure you're excited to have this decision made for the next Boston Public Schools superintendent. You had three finalists. What do you think ultimately tipped the scales in favor of Caselius?
Well, thank you, Kimberly. And, you know, it was really encouraging to have such a high caliber of candidates before us as a committee. And, you know, we took a look at each, and each presented a unique set of approaches to solving what the problems are in our schools and bringing our schools really to the next level. And we ultimately decided on Dr. Caselius because of the approach that she brings to the community. Her record as a leader in Minnesota, she was an eight-year Commissioner of Education in Minnesota. She worked across the aisle in a purple state. She was able to get things done. Early education was expanded. She had quite a bit of experience running middle schools in Memphis and in Minneapolis-St. Paul. She brought a broad wealth of experience, and her ability to uniquely reach out to a number of different constituencies across the city and across the district was really appealing to us and told us that this is somebody that's going to be able to get things done in Boston.
Now, the decision was not unanimous. There were two of the seven committee members voted in favor of Izquierdo, believing that she was better equipped to deal with things like closing the achievement gap. Mm-hmm. Also, initially, you'd hoped to have applicants with at least 5 years of superintendent experience, and none of the applicants ultimately had that. Do you think that this search still resulted in what will be an effective leader for BPS?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, this search, it was long. It was a very quiet search, but, you know, that's how these searches are designed to work. They're very much built off of trust and confidentiality for each of the candidates. And so, you know, throughout the 8 months, we were busy collecting through our search firm a number of applicants. We ended up with around 40 applicants, and we ended the search committee that we put together way back in October ultimately interviewed 12 candidates. And seven of those 12 candidates were either sitting or former big city superintendents. And so we had a high caliber of people before us. But, you know, it's a search committee, highly qualified, diverse set of constituents from across the city, sat there and pushed and pulled through each of these dozen candidates. Mm-hmm. These three emerged as the cream of the crop. And we're confident that particularly with Dr. Caselius, the skills that she brings to the table, she will be able to bring this district to the next level.
Edith, what do you think about the selection of Caselius?
Well, we certainly congratulate Dr. Casalius on her appointment as new superintendent of Boston Public Schools, and we know that the hard work of implementing the vision that she stated in her interview begins now. We believe that Dr. Casalius's success is tantamount to our students' success, but we also believe that there are bridges to be built. The superintendent's search process was flawed and damaged as it occurred, and Dr. Casalius will have to work to restore the trust. Her appointment needs to begin with building trust within the system and repairing this trust by being responsive, transparent to students, parents, and community members and advocates.
And Edith, I want to get to the point about what you expect her to do on the job, but I want to talk about the process a little bit. You co-authored a piece in Commonwealth Magazine, for example, really saying that there were flaws in the selection process. Talk a little more about that.
Well, I think that we would like to know who are the candidates in the pool that may have had urban superintendent experience that did not come to the finalist panel selection. And we also want to know if there were some candidates who have a proven track record of closing gaps within the district, because that is critical work. Boston is very complex, and we have a lot of issues that need to be addressed. So that experience was critically important, and we're not sure who the pool of candidates were and why we did not have someone that had that proven track record as well as some urban superintendency experience.
And Michael, what's your reaction to some of those concerns? There have been concerns
Sure.
that even though parents and community members were brought into this process, you say that it was more transparent than in the past, there are still a lot of folks who believe that it was not inclusive or transparent enough.
Right. And that's understood. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, this is a very long, drawn out process. And it's a process that looks very similar to the processes that we've engaged in the past. And, you know, these types of this is a job interview at its core. So it's built upon confidentiality. And, you know, we'd love to share each one of the individuals that applied for this job. But we can't do that because, you know, these people put themselves out there. Many of them are, again, you know, in sitting superintendencies elsewhere, and they have boards that are concerned about losing them as well. And so we need to respect the confidentiality of these individuals. And moreover, we need to respect what the process is. And, you know, when I talked about the search committee that we appointed back in October, we appointed a search committee of 11. We had the first student with a full voting participation in BPS history that sat on that search committee. We had school leaders, we had community leaders, members of the school committee, members from higher education. So we had a broad, diverse set of perspectives. And we trusted those individuals to go out there, work with our search firm, take a look at who it was that we were able to attract for this job, and then make the right choice about who they would put forward as finalists for our public consideration.
Now, Edith, you were talking a little bit about the need to restore trust in the school system. What do you think Superintendent-elect Casalius can do to make inroads at restoring that trust?
Sure. So first I want to respond to Mr. Locanto, and he's absolutely right. Confidentiality is very clearly important. However, we need to know if any of the finalists did have those credentials. And we weren't asking for names. We were just asking, you know, how many candidates had the track record of experience as well as the urban superintendency experience that were not in the finalist pool. So having said that, I think that Dr. Casalius would need to have a listening session with community, with parents, with students, and ensure that their voices are heard. Authentic family and community engagement is critical to Boston's success. And we need to engender some trust in the community that their voices are heard and the authentic input is recruited prior to any decision-making, and that their recommendations in terms of the targets and the priorities of the district in educating our students within the city of Boston are heard. So that'll be critically important for her to reach out to those community members who felt disenfranchised by the process and not included.
Oh, and the finalists, too, did not have any local ties, and some felt that the lack of understanding about the Boston community would be perilous to doing the job. Casalius was asked today on WBUR's Morning Edition how she plans to navigate those waters, not having any local connection to fall back on.
Just being very visible and getting out in the community right away and having conversations and discussions about their hopes and dreams for their children And so I think that what maybe will set me apart is that, you know, I want to make it my home and I want to participate in the community.
So how does she navigate and avoid the friction of being not someone who is as familiar with Boston Public Schools as others in the district?
Well, I think it starts with being herself, you know, and that's what we've told her throughout this process. You know, I mean, she's just such a natural uniter, you know, an individual that can find common ground with pretty much anyone she speaks to. And we've seen that throughout the interview process, throughout the public search panels last week, and really just in the community response. You know, I joked last night that we had a number of strange bedfellows, I think, between the organizations that were supporting her, certainly the broad-based support that you had on the search committee, the mayor's support. You know, we have a real opportunity to turn the tide with respect to the dialogue around what's happening in the schools. And Ms. Bazile and I were joking just outside, you know, I think the healing starts here today, right? You know, the opportunity for us to work together, particularly on common issues of common interest, you know, advocating up at the State House for the Promise Act and more state aid for local education units all across the Commonwealth is really an opportunity for us to work together on issues of common good. We all have at our base what we want that's best for our children, mm-hmm. for the kids that are in this city. Mm-hmm. And if we can start from there, we can do a lot of good work together.
Now, Edith, one of the issues that the new superintendent will have to deal with is the achievement gap. Here's how she says she'll work to make sure all students have access to a quality education and the opportunities that come with that.
There's just such a brain trust here. A lot of people just willing to dig into some of the really difficult issues, and it just felt like there was a readiness. And so I'm really eager to be part of that and to join the school committee and the mayor and to really leverage all resources so it's all hands on deck approach to really supporting kids in their learning.
Do you think that's the right approach?
I think it is the right approach, and I think that promoting core values of equity and inclusion are critical. And while I have issues with the term achievement gap, because I do believe it's an opportunity gap, it's a systemic district performance gap in terms of how supports, resources, and human capital are leveraged in schools. Schools need to be provided with equitable resources based upon their unique needs, based upon the population of students who may need something extra in addition to what all schools get. I think we really need to look at what makes a school successful and replicate that in every single school in the city of Boston, whether we're dealing with students of color, students from poverty, English language learners. We need to have those core supports that are unique to the students' needs and ensure that their trajectory of success, academic success, and outcomes are the same everywhere. So I think if we look at the systemic barriers in terms of policies that are in place that are implemented erratically or not equitably, then we can really think about what students need. We have a gap mm-hmm. in terms of Black teachers. We know that early grades where students are exposed to Black teachers based on the research can promote students' aspirations. We know that we have a problem with special education in terms of either the under-identification or the overrepresentation of some student populations, such as English language learners who may be misclassified or not receive services. We know that Black boys are over-identified in special ed. So there are a lot of issues that we need to deal with, but equity is the important piece in terms of how do we leverage the supports that schools need mm-hmm. in order for students to move from kindergarten, thinking about kindergarten and college.
That's Edith Bazile, president of the Black Educators Alliance of Massachusetts. Edith, thank you so much for coming on and speaking with us today.
Sure.
And Michael Lecanto, chair of the Boston School Committee, thank you for your time as well.
Thank you for having us.
For the first time, scientists say they may have seen a black hole swallow up a neutron star. The two massive objects have never before been observed together. The scientists, who are based out of LIGO, a gravitational wave observatory at MIT, and Virgo, also captured the sound of gravitational waves from two massive objects spiraling toward each other. It's one you may remember from 2015 when they first recorded the phenomena.
Just move a little bit.
joining me now to explain what it really means is news editor for Sky and Telescope magazine, Monica Young. Monica, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure, sure. So LIGO and Virgo are scanning the skies looking for gravitational waves to make these observations. Will you explain both what gravitational waves are and how they're detected?
Yeah, absolutely. So to kind of begin at the beginning, to say what gravitational waves are, you first have to know that about 100 years ago, Einstein totally changed how we think about gravity. So his theory of general relativity says that a massive object bends both space and time, and it's that bending of space-time that we call gravity. So any massive body that's moving through space-time is going to create these ripples that we in space-time that we call gravitational waves.
So
I was just going to give an analogy just so you can kind of picture it in your head a little bit better. If you put two bowling balls on a trampoline is kind of the standard picture that we use to visualize this. If you're bowling, each bowling bar is some massive object, let's say it's a star or something, and you start moving those bowling balls around each other so that they're circling each other, that's going to kind of cause these ripples in the fabric of the trampoline, right?
Yeah.
And so that's the kind of the ripples that we're seeing with these gravitational waves.
And thank you for that explanation. So I want to talk about what scientists believe they saw. First is a crash between two neutron stars. Just very significant. Scientists have made these possible observations. Also, potentially a neutron star colliding with a black hole in a separate detection. Sort of explain for our listeners exactly why this is a big deal.
Yeah, so, I mean, the reason gravitational waves are so neat is that they basically give us this new window onto the universe. It's kind of like if you have just been given the gift of hearing. If you've always seen waterfalls and then you're suddenly able to hear, you have this whole new dimension that you're able to use to understand, you know, how waterfalls happen. And so it's the same kind of thing is happening here. Now that we can see these gravitational waves coming to us from these neutron star mergers and from these from the black hole swallowing a neutron star, we can better understand what's happening on the insides of these neutron stars, and we can get a better idea of what's – we can't see inside a black hole, unfortunately, but we can see what's right around the event horizon, that kind of point of no return that defines the edge of a black hole.
Now, LIGO and Virgo went offline back in 2017, in part to make improvements. But back in 2017, the detectors picked up two neutron stars colliding in gravitational waves. That was a major first. And then a few weeks ago, it captured this first image of the supermassive black hole, if you remember from a couple weeks back. Do you think we're getting any closer to understanding black holes and how they relate to Einstein's theory of relativity?
Yeah, I mean, definitely the advances that we're making in technology are enabling us to test Einstein's theory of general relativity better and better. And relativity is basically where the theory of black holes comes about. Black holes are basically like if you took that bowling ball in the center of the trampoline and you just pulled it all the way down to infinity, that's kind of how you can picture black holes. They're almost like holes in the fabric of space-time. Being able to study gravitational waves from these regions where it's very, very strong gravity, we can put Einstein's general relativity to the test. And so far, general relativity has passed every test we've thrown at it with flying colors. But at some point, it has to break down because at the center of a black hole is that singularity. And general relativity can't explain that singularity. Hopefully, as the technology continues to advance, we're going to be able to get a better understanding. Keep testing general relativity and get a better understanding of it.
And if that technology does advance, what's next? What are you hoping to learn?
Well, I think the neat things that are going to be happening. So, LIGO and Virgo. Those are the two sets of detectors that are looking at gravitational waves. They just went online in April, and they're going to be going through till next April. And they've already detected so many events. So before we were seeing like maybe an event a month of these gravitational waves, and now we're seeing. So far, we have five candidate events. They haven't been fully vetted yet. But five candidates within just the past month. And so within the next year, we're going to be learning, we're going to be able to study not just individual events, but we're going to be able to study neutron stars and black holes like as populations. these mergers between these objects. And then hopefully, you know, fingers crossed, we might actually be able to find different types of sources. So black hole and neutron star mergers are kind of the bread and butter for LIGO and Virgo, but they might be able to detect supernova explosions, spinning neutron stars, and there might even be, you know, totally new exotic objects out there for them to detect.
Oh, that's very exciting. That's Monica Young, news editor for Sky and Telescope magazine. Monica, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
And stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use. And we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Boston has some of the worst traffic in the country. A Mass Inc. poll last week found that commutes are so bad, some people are considering leaving the region altogether. To see what other places are doing to ease road congestion, WBUR's Zeninjor and Wameka recently traveled to Mexico City to report on their bus system. Here's her series, Viva Buses, has been airing all week, and she joins us now. Zeninjor, thanks so much.
Hi, Kimberly. Thanks for having me.
So first off, I want to know, what made Mexico City the destination when looking at public transportation?
Yeah, well, buses took me there. And, you know, Mexico City has what's considered a world-class bus rapid transit system. Their system is called Metrobus, and it's really a fast, efficient, and reliable bus service. And it moves a lot of people down there. And I should note, too, that many cities in the world have this type of bus system. The first BRT system actually started in Brazil. And now you can find these systems throughout Latin America, as well as in Europe, Africa, and Asia. There's also a few cities in the U.S. that have it, too.
So you were there. Tell us what these systems are like.
Yeah, so the system really mimics a rail experience. I think that's the best way to describe it. It really feels like you're riding a subway. And that's for a few reasons. The buses have their own separate lanes, so they have they also have priority at traffic signals, so the buses can clear intersections much faster. And boarding the buses is also similar to a subway, too. You pay at the station instead of on board. So you're not waiting for everyone to tap their card. You're also able to just board through any door. It's really just so much faster and more comfortable, too, because you're on a platform, kind of like a subway. So you don't have to climb on the bus. You just walk forward. And I noticed that that made it easier for people with mobility issues, too, to get on the bus.
So these aren't the buses we see going up and down Com Ave, clearly. So did you find that Mexico City had things that we could learn from, things that the MBTA can learn from?
Yeah, well, Mexico City is interesting to look at because it's a massive city, 10 million people in the city alone, about 21 million in the metro area. So that's a lot of people who need to get around there. And Mexico City built its BRT system fairly recently. The first line opened in 2006, and that was just after a couple years of planning. And their newest line actually just opened last year. They've seen a lot of success so far. The system has actually reduced travel times by 40%, according to officials there. And it moves 1.5 million riders every day, which is more than what the entire MBTA moves daily. I spoke to a lot of the riders down there. Here's Javier Paz, who works in downtown Mexico City.
Metrobus is really, really, really useful for people like me that use it every day for work. It's a matter of economy, too, because six pesos for a ride to south, to north, to the city is great.
The system is really popular there, as you can hear. And, you know, it's so popular that the system is just about maxed out. I mean, the buses get really packed down there during rush hour.
Okay, so you rode these buses. Tell us what you think about them.
Yeah, so I actually rode almost every line in the system. There's seven lines altogether in Mexico City. I think there is only maybe two that I didn't get to, but I did a lot of bus rides. And I have to say, you know, I ride the bus pretty regularly here in Boston. So it's interesting to compare that experience. And, you know, in Boston, I'm so used to waiting a really long time. Sometimes the buses don't come. You're waiting forever. I'm sure many people can relate to that. And that just wasn't the case in Mexico City. Mm-hmm. I never had to wait for a Metro bus. They just kept coming, even when it was really busy and packed. They kept coming one after the other. And I actually learned from visiting a control center down there that the buses are spaced just 2-3 minutes apart, sometimes even less than that in rush hour. It's definitely a much different bus experience. But I have to say, I did have an interesting experience in Mexico City where I was out at a meeting and there was no BRT line around me. And so I did what I usually do in Boston, which is I called an Uber. And it was actually kind of a mistake. I ended up just frustrated and stuck in Mexico City's rush hour, and I made this recording.
All right. So I'm currently sitting in an Uber and sort of experiencing the other side here. We've just passed a couple of Metro bus stations along Reforma, and they've just sped right past us and supposed to be somewhere at 5:30. And I'm just watching our navigation here tick up, up, up. Now it's giving me an estimate of 5:45. And these Metro buses have just sped right on past us, and we're just stuck here in traffic.
Yeah, so at that moment, I really experienced what I heard from a lot of Metro bus riders there, which is that, you know, the Metro bus system is great, but they want more of it because it's really only centrally located in Mexico City and it doesn't reach all parts of the city.
Wow. Wow. So you went down with a group of business leaders from Boston who were part of a research trip. What were their takeaways?
Yeah, they were pretty impressed by the system. I think some folks felt that, you know, if Mexico City could make this work, we could certainly make something like it work here. As you know, transportation is such a huge challenge for our region, and several local business groups have been gathering to discuss possible solutions. The group that went down to Mexico City from the Alliance for Business Leadership really wanted to gather information and experience the system firsthand. So they spent 3 days down there and at the end of the trip gathered to discuss their impressions and what they want to do back in Boston. So here's Beverly Armstrong of Brazo Fuerte Artisanal Beer, Dave McLaughlin of WeWork, and Joanne Pokaski of Beth Israel.
I can now see ways that we can reduce that time and make the system much more efficient, which is helpful for my customers, certainly getting to my place of business.
If you close your eyes, you feel like you're on a subway because the speed of people getting on and off and then the speed that the vehicle's moving, it just feels like the subway. So I think that's awesome and a little bit enlightening for me.
Transportation is also a big workforce issue, and how can we raise transportation when we're talking about our workforce issues and make sure more people understand that this is a problem we need to be focusing on for the health of our economy?
Yeah, so everyone went home with some different ideas of what they'd like to see in Boston and how they might advocate for it. And as you heard there, you know, these are critical issues that affect everyone, obviously, and there's certainly a lot of interest now in the business community to really think about policies, solutions, things that maybe the business community could push for.
So what is the T doing that's anything remotely like what's happening in Mexico City in the few seconds we have left?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, communities in Greater Boston have been testing elements of bus rapid transit. So you're seeing several bus lanes in throughout the region, Arlington, Cambridge, Boston, Everett. So far, these bus lanes have you know, worked. They've sped up commutes, reduced travel times. And I spoke with some riders who are on some of these bus lanes that you're seeing popping up. I went over to Mount Auburn Street, where there's a bus-only lane between Watertown and Cambridge, and spoke to Morgan Burke, who is a student.
In the era before the bus lane, it took a lot longer. Right now, during rush hour, it takes maybe 20 minutes.
What was it like before?
Like at least 10 minutes longer.
Oh, so it's been faster for you.
Yeah, it's been faster.
Yeah, so, you know, some of the riders here in the Boston area are getting a little bit of a taste of bus rapid transit, but there's still a ways to go to get a full-on BRT system.
WBUR reporter Zeninjor Nwameka, if you want to see photos of the Mexico BSU system, her series is available on our website, radioboston.org. Zeninjor, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure, thanks.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Kimberly Atkins, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Late in the 8 o'clock hour of September 11th, 2001, on ABC's Good Morning America, hosts Charlie Gibson and Diane Sawyer updated their viewers on what had already happened.
We just got a report in that there's been some sort of explosion at the World Trade Center in New York City. One report said, and we can't confirm any of this, that a plane may have hit one of the two towers of the World Trade Center. But again, you're seeing the live pictures here.
As their TV cameras brought viewers live images, just minutes later, they checked in with a reporter on the scene who described the fire and smoke billowing from that first tower.
As fire crews are descending on this area, it does not appear that there's any kind of an effort up there yet. Now remember, oh my God.
Oh my God.
That looks like a second plane.
I did not see a plane go in. That just exploded.
We just saw another plane coming in from the side.
And within moments, the gravity of the situation started to sink in.
Oh, this is terrifying. Awful.
To watch powerless is a horror.
That fateful day, 18 years ago, four planes were commandeered by al-Qaeda terrorists, used in a coordinated attack on New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania, killing 2,997 and changing the course of American history. In a new book, Boston journalist Mitchell Zukoff brings us back to that moment and masterfully pulls together the story of some of the remarkable people on that day, offering a minute-by-minute account of what happened. It's titled Fall and Rise, the story of 9/11. Zukoff was a reporter at the Boston Globe on 9/11. He's now a professor of journalism at Boston University. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Kim.
Just preliminarily, I should note that your daughter, Eve, is one of our producers on the show, but she did not produce this segment.
And she would not share any questions with me, so her loyalties are clear.
Well, look, this is your book. You spent so much time with this. In some ways, hearing the tape of that day, and we all remember where we were, it brings it back like it was yesterday. But in some ways, it feels like it was so long ago. We don't even talk about Al-Qaeda that much anymore. Talk about that. Why did you write this book now?
You've put your finger right on it. It is both present for us and quite distant. And so we have an entire generation with no independent memories of those moments you just played. And we also have folks like us who were there, who remember it, and yet have, memories start to fade. And so we're at this kind of inflection point, I think, that we have to capture this now where we can still do it as news. Once it falls into the well of history, we can look back at it the way we do Pearl Harbor or Gettysburg or you name it. But it's still so present in our lives. We have 18-year-olds going off to fight in a war that started as a result of these attacks who had no independent memory of it. Mm. So to connect them to it was the idea behind the book.
And we're talking about remembering that day. Take us back there. What were you doing on that day?
Sure. I was actually not at the Globe. I was home on book leave trying to write my first book. And when the first plane went in, I was like most people. We were, we were naive. We were thinking, what kind of pilot could hit a twin tower on such a beautiful day and clear day? When the second plane went in, Flight 175, I rushed to the phone. It was ringing before I got there, and it was my editor telling me, your book leave is over. So I raced to the Globe, and very quickly it was established that I would be writing the lead news story for the day and taking feeds from several dozen of our colleagues who were everywhere at once, it felt like. It was an all-hands-on-deck moment.
And so that became my responsibility that day.
And as you said, the narrative for the book began from the reporting for the Globe immediately after those attacks. We know that two of those four planes, American Airlines Flight 11 and United Flight 175, took off from Boston Logan Airport before hijacking and crashing into each of the Twin Towers. How did you capture the stories about how 9/11 affected the folks in and around Boston?
That was such an important element of that, Kim, because it was a local story as well as a historic story. We knew that these were our neighbors who were on those two planes. We had a colleague at the Boston Globe whose father was on Flight 11, as you know. And so, you know, we felt this responsibility and almost immediately, and this is one of the wonderful things I think about local journalism, we realized that we knew some of the people. We had connections. We were one degree apart from them. Caroline Louise Cole had written about John Oganowski, the pilot of Flight 11. Mm-hmm. She had been up on his farm talking about the work he had done with Cambodian refugees. Not that long before. So she could very quickly access those stories and the friends of his and the family members. So we were able to sort of sweep into the community that way. And the work I've done since is really piggybacking on those first days.
And you talk about the stories of the people. You talk about a host of people who had connections, particularly to these two flights, including the youngest victim of 9/11, two-year-old Christine Hansen, who was flying with her parents on what should have been a very joyous trip. Talk a little bit about her.
Sure. So Christine was the daughter of Peter and Sue Kim Hansen. They lived here in Massachusetts. They were flying out to Disneyland in California. Peter mm-hmm. was going to do some business out there. Sue Kim had was just about to get her PhD here at Boston University. This was just a beautiful young family. And when Flight 175 was hijacked, Peter Hansen was able to get a phone call off to Lee and Eunice Hansen, his parents in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And he told, "Dad, you know, tell the airline what's going on. We've been hijacked." And Lee Hansen called the local police department because he couldn't get the airline, and they told him, "Turn on the TV, Mr. Hansen." And so Lee and Eunice Hansen ended up watching the TV, and then Peter called back as they were watching, and Peter was actually comforting them, comforting his father, saying, "Dad, don't worry, it'll be fast," even as he's comforting and huddling against Christine and Sue Kim. So I spent time with Lee and Eunice Hansen and in their home in Easton, Connecticut, in Peter's boyhood bedroom. And going back to your first question, you know, why now? Well, in the time, in the 2 or 3 years since I first met the Hansons, Lee has since passed away. Mm-hmm. So these stories, we need to catch them now.
And another story that you talk about, perhaps the last victim to learn about the attacks, is Elaine Dutch. She was severely burned, and she was in a coma for months afterwards.
Indeed. So Elaine was on the 88th floor of the North Tower. It was significant because she was the one who was about to that day get the documents to transfer the lease from the Twin Towers to private management. So this was a momentous day for the towers, and she was the recipient of these. So she stepped out into the hallway to get the messenger, and just then Flight 11 hits, a fireball comes down the elevator shaft and consumes her. And Elaine, by coincidence, I saw Elaine on Tuesday night.
Oh, wow.
And spent some time with her and her family. And Elaine heroically found a way to get down on her own two feet the entire 88 stories, but then, if you know about burns, at first you go into shock and the nerve endings are gone, but the pain comes later. And so, yes, she spent months in a coma, a medically induced coma, before she knew that the towers where she had worked for decades were gone. Friends were gone. It was she was in many ways for me a proxy for the confusion of all this.
So 9/11 is something that obviously has never left our consciousness, and you are writing about it in this really powerful way, telling these personal stories about the folks affected by it. I want to talk a little bit about how we talk about 9/11. Recently, Minnesota Democratic Representative Ilhan Omar came under fire for using the term "some people did something." She was making a broader point about how Muslims have been portrayed and treated in the United States since 9/11. But she came under criticism for diminishing what 9/11 was. What did you think of her comments, and what do you think more broadly about how we, moving forward in history, talk about 9/11?
Sure. Well, I think that any discussion of 9/11, particularly by public officials, should take pains to express reverence and respect for the victims, the survivors, and their families. And I think should make plain exactly who was responsible and should not glide past that. Now, of course, absolutely, we can also talk about and should talk about Islamophobia and unfortunate and wrongheaded efforts to equate American Muslims with al-Qaeda. But I think we owe a responsibility to the people who were so deeply affected and to all of us to not glide past that. And in terms of how we talk about it, I think maybe I'm an optimist, but I still believe we can get back to the unity that we had as a country immediately after. We understood that all Americans were attacked, regardless of race or creed or religion. Every imaginable kind of American was affected directly. If you look at the faces of the lost at the 9/11 memorial, you realize this is the mosaic of America. And we put aside petty politics. We put aside partisan sniping in the immediate aftermath. And what I would love to see is some memory of that.
So the story that you tell is also one of technology. It was just under 20 years ago, but we collectively watched these events unfold on our televisions. And we saw graphic images of what was ensuing. We watched the towers fall and how that affected everyone. And you also write about the communications of the folks on the planes were having with their loved ones through cell phones and their in-seat phones. Talk a little bit about the communication, how that is also another character in your book.
Very much so. It's so powerful. Well, the first real experience of that, I was down on Cape Cod talking with a woman named Julie Sweeney Roth, and her husband, Brian Moose Sweeney, was on the second plane, and he left her a voicemail, and she played it for me. And she knew every word, every pause, every inflection. He was a former fighter pilot, a former Top Gun instructor, and he had left her this beautiful message. And so the technology is sort of preserved Brian's spirit that way. Mm-hmm. And then again and again, I was hearing these messages, or I was hearing some version of them. And, you know, where the story really sort of coalesces is on Flight 93. Where all these people who are now hearing from their loved ones, hey, this is not isolated. You're the fourth plane at least that has been hijacked.
This is the plane that crashed into in Pennsylvania.
Precisely. And so they were the last one. And this was the group of 40 crew members and passengers who decided to do something. And one of the lesser known calls actually was between the mother-in-law of one of the passengers there and 911. She had called 911 for advice. And so that's an entire recorded call.
Wow.
And you have Joanne Makeley. You hear her saying to her daughter, who's talking to her son-in-law on the plane, make him brave.
Hmm.
That was what your job is to do right now, she said to her daughter.
So this is obviously a fact-based account that is that builds upon or draws together a lot of in-depth reporting at the time as well as subsequently. But there's a lot of pseudoscience and conspiracy theories that are still prevalent 18 years later after 9/11. Having written about this, having done so much reporting, what do you think is the reason why some of these conspiracy theories have had legs and lasted this long?
I think whenever we have a major event, inevitably it feels as though there's some part of human nature that wants to come up with alternative explanations. And that is certainly true for 9/11. I've spent a lot of time reading a lot of these conspiracy theories. And frankly, it is the exact opposite of what we do. exact opposite of journalism. They're starting with a conclusion, and they're backfilling information, not facts, but information to fit that predetermined conclusion rather than starting with a question. What happened? Who did this? How did it happen? Why did the towers fall? And the result is, you know, when if you do the work that we do, if you go after these theories, it ends up being like a game of whack-a-mole. You know, you knock one down and three more pop up. So the best we can do, I hope, and the reason why there are, you know, almost 1,000 citations of facts in my book, although I tell it as a narrative, the idea is if you want to know how do we know this? How do we know that this person said this? How do we know that the towers were built this way? Or what is the point at which structural steel loses its integrity? I can tell you. This is how I know that.
So you talk a lot about what happened during and after the attack. You don't talk a lot about what led to them, what failures or missed intelligence. Talk about your process and your approach a little bit.
Sure. You know, I'm vividly aware this is not the first book on 9/11. And I think some other writers and reporters have done extraordinarily good work on the lead up. You know, I say in the opening of the book, I bow to the work of Larry Wright in the Looming Tower, you know, who traces all the forces leading up to September 10th. And so one volume can only do something so well. And just as he stopped on September 10th, I picked up the story on September 10th. And of course, I make sweeping statements about the lead up and, you know, the fatwa from Osama bin Laden. But that's a different volume.
Yeah. So if it seems, though, for those who remember 9/11, it serves as a dividing line in our recent history. There's pre-9/11 and post-9/11. We even talk about that, whether it's how we go through TSA or how other things have changed after that event. Do you think there's a need to sort of bridge that? I mean, is that division something that needs to be overcome, or do we need to keep that line very bright?
It's interesting. I'm not sure we do need to overcome it because we live – this is the water we swim in now. And you know, what happened before is a memory. And maybe for some of us it's a sweet memory, and certainly for a lot of the people who I wrote about, talking about September 10th was the hardest part of it for them because life was different for them. They were worried about, you know, who was going to get the dog to the vet kind of stuff. Mm. And then all this happened. But I think we are changed by this. We're changed as a culture. We're changed as individuals by it. And so I'm not sure there is any going back.
So the book begins with the fall, the attack, and what happened immediately after. And then there's a section, Rise from the Ashes, tying together the threads of the stories that you're telling of all these people throughout. And then you leave the story there. Why stop there?
Mm. You know, every story is kind of an organic being. And if, you know, it constantly changes and you have to make decisions about where to go. And again, I found that the Rise story, the story of the aftermath and pulling together the strands of what happened to these people, in many ways, the story, you know, it's not an easy story to tell. It's not an easy thing for them to experience. But there's moments of grace and there's moments of uplift that we were not defeated and they were not individually defeated. And we are stronger in the broken places. And that became the kind of driving force. And I, in a way, I couldn't wait to write the third part because I spent all these years living with the fall from the sky and the fall to the ground. And I knew there was something that comes after.
And what lessons do you think folks will take away from this book, or what do you hope that they take away from it?
I think there are two kinds of lessons, Kim. One is I want them to connect to the individuals. I want 9/11 not to be simply a math problem, if you will, where we know the number of people killed. And we know that there were 19 hijackers and 4 planes and the numbers of the planes. But when you connect to Elaine or you connect to Christine Hansen or you connect to the men of Ladder 6 or Colonel Wills crawling across a burning floor in the Pentagon with a woman on her back, You will never forget those people. So that's one lesson. And then the other lesson is kind of a bigger lesson, a more macro lesson for all of us and for our leaders, that we have to not be fighting the last wars. We have to make sure we're anticipating the possibilities of what comes next. You know, on 9/11, the reason why I delve into some of this, and this is the more investigative side of the book, you know, that we had 12 names on the FAA no-fly list and 60,000 names on the State Department tip-off list, but they weren't communicating with each other. The head of the FAA security didn't know the other list existed. They were worried about Russian bombers coming over the pole. So both the macro and the personal.
All right. Michael Zukoff is a professor of journalism at Boston University. Mitchell Zukoff, I'm sorry. Sorry about that. His latest book is Fall and Rise, The Story of 9/11. He'll be at the Brookline Booksmith tonight. And there's more information about that on our website, radioboston.org. Mitchell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kim, so much.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.